This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
When I started this show a few months ago, I said business to me was nothing overcomplicated, right? But just a story of relationships that surround money and its pursuit to whatever ends. Now, we often focus on the men and women in the front office, reviewing their plans and high-fiving their successes and interrogating their losses. Their success or failures have as much to do with the people in their workplace. It's often dismissed as a soft issue, I guess, but the mental well-being of the people ensuring strategies are followed are perhaps the most important ingredient to any organization. Now, I often wonder about the state of mind of an employee in an under-pressure company, say an Eskom, and that employer that isn't to blame for the governance collapses in recent years, and are not one of the 3,000 odd employees that are alleged to have had some questionable private dealings with the company. Just what is their mental state every time they enter that megawatt park every day? And is it a state of mind that is conducive to turning around the most important company in the country? So in our Power Boardroom conversation this Wednesday, as it's Mental Health Month, we thought we'd have a conversation about mental health in the workplace. Up until very recently, South Africans barely spoke about depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, amongst other things. So one can only imagine how taboo it is in settings that are meant to be professional, performance-driven, and emotional only if it is productive. Our working spaces are not only potential seedbeds for mental illness, but also can also be places where our mental health gets worse. According to the South African Federation for Mental Health, employee absenteeism, largely as a result of depression and other associated mental illnesses, costs the South African economy between 12 billion and 16 billion rand annually. Now, mental illness can be triggered by a myriad of factors, but work requires a certain level of professionalism and performance that may conflict with the person's state of mind. It's needless to say that dynamics between mental illness and their work is a complex and expensive one. And today we're unpacking mental illness in the workplace for this very reason, and there are economic and business implications to a country treating mental illness like a deep, dark secret. Joining us in studio is industrial psychologist Leonard Carr and Dandaswa Fubu, Group Executive, Human Capital Transformation and Internal Audit at Barloworld. Good evening, and thank you very much for coming in studio.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you. Dandaswa, I'll start with you. I mean, can you speak to us as an executive in human capital on the general corporate attitude towards mental illness?
You know, Ron, I think it's like the other diseases that we have dealt with, where at first there was almost like a denial that it's not there, it's not happening. That happened with the HIV and AIDS at some point. And I think we are at a point where, as corporates, we're starting to say we cannot deny that this is happening anymore. It is with us, and therefore, what is it that we need to be doing to ensure that we capacitate ourselves as managers, as executives, but also how do we make sure that the space within the corporate office is conducive for someone who is suffering from mental health to be able to come forward and to have the comfort that it is a safe space for that person to speak up and that there will be help for that person.
Leonard, with regards to you, just the general corporate attitude towards mental illness.
Okay, so first of all, I'm a clinical psychologist, not industrial. So I think one of the biggest pitfalls is that people think that mental illness is a sign of weakness. And particularly as it pertains to the workplace, the reason that people get burnout or break down is not because of weakness, it's actually because of strength. And what happens is that because people are scared of appearing weak or appearing as if they're underperforming or appearing unprofessional, they master their strength and they push on and on and on until their strength starts to work against them. And then by the time the illness shows up, it's often difficult to treat, and then they have to take off work, and then, you know, sometimes have to be hospitalized. So if there was more sensitivity towards it, and if people got past this myth that mental illness is, number one, caused by, you know, a weak constitution, or it's a sign of a psychological problem, if they got past that and people could report things early on and the workplaces we're more sensitive and sympathetic to people's stress levels, people's, you know, workload distribution, all of those kinds of things, and supported resilience more, then a lot of this workplace mental illness could be prevented.
I mean, let's talk about the language around mental health in all settings, but specifically at work. How do we, I guess, remain empathetic and sensitive to it?
Well, I think that the first step is actually to recognize that we're all human. We all have our limitations. We all need sleep. We all need actually fun and time out. You know, if you treat someone like a machine and they lose touch with their humanity, they lose empathy with themselves, they become robotic, they become machine-like, they start to become alienated from themselves, and that also causes them to be alienated from others, and then you get conflicts in the home, you get people pushing themselves beyond their limits, you know, becoming workaholics, being overtired, that leads to irritability. It leads to greater anxiety, which leads to frustration and anger and outbursts. People stop taking care of their nutrition, stop doing exercise. When people are under stress, the first thing to go is gym. Gym is one of the best natural remedies for anxiety and depression. So workplaces have to become more humane in letting people keep proper hours, not treating it like it's something to be commended when people stay late, come ridiculously early at work, stay ridiculously late, neglect their family life, neglect themselves. People should be encouraged to take off time to attend, for instance, children's sports matches. And if they became focused on the quality of what people produce rather than making sure that people are kept like little hamsters on a wheel in constant production, you would get better results and you'd have more sustainability because people's mental well-being would be better and you'd have better retention because a company that supports people's mental well-being is a company that people will want to stay in for a long time.
And that's all?
You know, I agree with what Len is saying. What we lack generally in corporate is that humanity. And you find that where we are starting to grapple with mental health and mental ill health, people are saying, where are the policies? You know, what's the mental health policy? And my retort to that is, you actually do not need a policy. You need to just be humane and treat people like that. As you said, people are not machines. And if you are a manager, a line manager, an executive that is attuned to the people that you work with, you are most likely to be able to even detect the changes in the people's behaviors and the personas, how they, you know, how they come to work, how they project themselves. And you can start an early intervention and ensure that, as Lena said, it doesn't get to be full-blown depression, but you catch it early enough and you are able to help the people. And I'll give you examples. With us, what we have started doing is to have internal psychologists that when we detect that there's something that might not be quite right with someone, or when, for instance, someone is going through a divorce, you do not know the emotions that the person is going through. So what do we do best is to ensure that we put people in touch with people who are best able to help them. But more than that, it's about giving people time off. We don't have, for instance, a sabbatical policy, but with the rise in the consciousness and awareness around mental health, what we've had to do is to say, what does this person need from the company right now? How can we practically help the person? And part of the things that we've done is to say, okay, we will give someone time off, fully paid time off, and ensure that in the time that the person is off, they're getting the help that they need so that they can come back and be fully functional. And from myself, I'm also talking from a personal point of view, because this year I had a very severe depression bout that I went through. And I was not functional. There was nothing that I could do.
Mm.
And the support that I got from the organization, the support that I got from my CEO was just amazing to say, take the time off, do what you need to do, see who you need to see to heal. Do not think about work. Do not worry that your stuff
it'll
is not...
fall apart because you're not
exactly.
here. That's the whole thing.
Exactly.
Fear, right?
Actually, they used to send me pictures of my boss with my team saying, we've got this,
yeah.
you know, just concentrate on getting better.
Mm.
And I think that's the humanity that you want to see in corporate.
Mm. I'll pose this question to both of you. Is professional conduct humane? I mean, in the traditional form of how we understand it.
In the sense of how people treat
yeah.
others?
In the professional setting. Mm.
You know, I think one can't generalize. Mm. You know, one of the biggest mistakes I made very, very early in my career, which was about 35 years ago, was I told someone to confide in their boss.
Mm.
And I was sure the boss would understand. It was a big mistake because what happened was that the boss said, well, you obviously can't cope with the job. You're obviously underperforming and fired them.
Mm.
But, you know, I think one has to assess, you know, what kind of workplace people are in. And I found in my experience, generally, the world has become more sophisticated than it was in those days. Mm. And my experience has been that bosses are generally humane and accommodating when people explain. And, of course, that's if people are good performers.
Mm.
You know, and the boss realizes that this is not someone taking advantage. I think the other thing, just to make the point, that one's got to realize that mental health issues are the same as any other physical issues like diabetes or epilepsy or anything. And so one's got to have the same approach to talking about them and to treating them, you know. Because people think they're in a separate category.
Mm-hmm.
And then they become shame attached to them.
And it's always seen as a sign of almost of weakness within the corporation.
Right.
Mm. Yeah.
Just on the professionalism, Ron, I think it also depends on how you define professionalism and from whose perspective are you defining that. Because you will find some people, for them, professionalism is being at work at 7, as you said, and leaving at 9, irrespective of the output, you know, during that time.
Mm.
And for some people, professionalism is when I say to my boss, I will give you this at this time. I do just that, irrespective of when I come and go, you know, in
right.
the office.
Mm.
So we need to factor that in, that what professionalism is to me might be different to you. And there is nothing in my view that makes you less professional when you are humane.
Mm.
Actually, for me, I don't see why those things should be, you know, two different things. Exactly.
Mm.
And if I am professional, it means that I care about the people that I work with.
Mm.
Because if I don't care about the people that I work with, how do I hope that we are going to achieve what we want to achieve as an organization?
Mm-hmm.
You know, organizations go around glibly saying people are assets. And maybe we should stop saying people are assets because we start treating them like machines.
Mm-hmm.
We should say people are people, you know, and we rely on
Absolutely.
People to do what we need to do as an organization. Maybe we should just change our narrative
mm-hmm.
because then how we treat people should show up as, you know, as humane.
All right. Thank you very much. We have to take a break for Power Headlines and we'll get back to our conversation with clinical psychologist Leonard Carr and Dandaswa Fubu, Group Executive, Human Capital Transformation and Internal Audit at Barloworld. Welcome back as we continue our discussion on mental health in our Power Boardroom segment. And joining me in studio is clinical psychologist Lena Carr and Dandaswa Fubu, Group Executive at Barloworld. And we have a couple of callers on the line. We'll Nina from Craig Hall.
Hi, Ron. Good evening to you and your guests.
Good evening.
If I can just throw in a few points.
Yep.
You know, I liked your question about the kind of language that is used around this question that is being discussed.
Mm.
And the first thing that I just want to point out is that effectively 25 years ago, in other words, at the point of our shift into this new dispensation, mental illness and criminality actually fell under the same laws. So I think we need to know, and this is in fact true internationally. So although now there's a discourse which tries to avoid that reality, we have to know that those kind of stigmas are still part, really, of the discourse, obviously, because nothing that happened 25 years ago is irrelevant. So I would argue that we are still definitely a highly stigma-based society if you look at things like homosexuality, for instance. And I would say the same thing about mental health. Now, I think that in Japan, this is in the last few years, so I stand to be corrected, but there was specific terminology that was evolved to talk about what happens with this problem of overwork in a society. And I'd say, at the very least, we should maybe be talking about stress overload rather than, in fact, invoking concepts like mental health, which have a lot of strange reverberations surrounding it, and the dangers of people, in other words, the people running businesses, still holding prejudicial and outdated ideas. So, I think there's different ways of handling people who are running corporations and how their thinking has to evolve in a profound manner. And then the people who actually are suffering from the problem of stress overload, and what happens when inappropriate stigmatization because of inappropriate terminology is utilized. And just for the record, in terms of the psychological community, there has been gigantic discourse around terminology and the signification of terminology. Those are my points. Thanks so much, Ron.
Thank you very much for that, Nina. Next on the line, we have Stanley from Pretoria. Stanley?
How's it going?
Yeah, in corner, bro.
Good. Quick question, for your guest. How does one deal with a subordinate that seems to be reporting in your line manager, but that person actually reports to you? When they must come for performance review and everything, approvals, they are a subordinate. But for some reason, it looks like you and the person reports to the same person. How do you deal with that professionally?
All right, Stanley, thank you for that. I'll put it to the panelists in studio. Thanks, Bob.
Sure.
To Nina's point about the stigmatization, I guess, of mental health. Yeah? You want to go with it?
So if one wants to look at the narrative, actually what's changed in the narrative is that we've shifted from an industrial age where people were educated and treated like machines, like factory workers. There was uniformity. There was a kind of production line mentality. Mental health issues were seen to interfere with productivity. People were easily replaceable. One fell off the machine, just put another one back onto the machine. And we're now living in a very different age, which is a knowledge worker age, and we see this in especially in younger people, that people expect to be treated like human beings. People expect to be treated in a holistic way and for their subjective worlds to be taken into account. So it's really about corporates getting with the program and learning to have a more holistic view of people. And I think it's not just about stress. It's about looking at people in all the different aspects of their lives and creating an environment that are conducive for people to be healthy within their personal and work environments.
Can I just add again, Ron? In my view, if we're not going to be calling out what the illness is about, then we're going to take a long time to destigmatize the illness.
I agree with that.
If we're gonna call it overstressed and it's something beyond being overstressed and it's manifesting in something else, and we're also gonna miss the chance to deal with the with the core of what the problem is. So I would really caution against that.
Now, I want to talk about high-performing employees who are struggling with mental illness, but how difficult is it to intervene when a person is seems highly functional in the workplace?
Again, for me, I'll take it from a personal experience because I was functional. And when I look back, I actually had been living with depression for a number of months. But because it's almost like you switched on and you just keep going, like you said. Right. I kept going. It took me going to a meeting with my boss after about 4 months. And he asked one question, how are you? The meeting was over because I couldn't answer. I just sobbed. And he didn't know what was happening. And what I appreciate and what he did for me was to get me to go to a doctor. So I was put in front of a doctor. And that's when the diagnosis started. And then I went for counseling. But it's very easy sometimes, Ron, to just go while you're sick. And I tend to say now to people, do not postpone sickness. Because when it hits you, it hits you very hard. If I had taken a step back when I started not being okay. Because also, when I look back, I should have seen the signs. I shouldn't have disregarded them. I should have
done. It's easy to disregard them, right? Because you're functioning in work, you're meeting all your targets, or everyone.
You're outperforming, you're doing everything.
You're fine as well.
Exactly. Talking, right? And especially for people like me, I love laughing, for instance. And because I laugh, then I think people can also be fooled to think that I'm super happy. And I'm laughing because that thing is funny at that time. You know, and it's just, it gets you to, you need to be in touch with yourself and know yourself and know where there are triggers and when you are likely to go off the rails.
You see, people also tend to find other reasons for why they're feeling. And this even applies to things like hearing loss or vision loss. You'll find that people go for a checkup, or for some reason they get tested and they didn't actually realize they were losing vision or hearing or some other bodily function. And people will say it's age, or it's this change or that change, because it creeps up so insidiously that you get habituated to it. You get accustomed to it while it's happening. And it's only when it crosses a threshold where you can really see that you can't deny it anymore, that there's something wrong. That's when people go for help. And if it was about weakness, then people would go for help right at the beginning, as soon as they felt any discomfort. And so in that sense, weakness is a huge advantage.
To get through it. Can a working environment be a trigger for depression or anxiety? We always hear people talk about toxic work environments, but can it actually be the trigger of depression and anxiety?
There's absolutely no question about it. First of all, the higher you get, the more narcissists you tend to find. And the thing is that narcissists, one of the features of narcissism is a lack of empathy. Narcissists tend to be machine-like in their normal way of being. And so they, number one, don't have empathy for others. They tend to be exploitative. They tend to undermine people. They tend to take credit for other people's work. They tend to practice things like divide and rule. They can be passive-aggressive and subtly abusive and, you know, even outright harassing or, you know, sexual harassment or whatever it is. And so basically one can become a victim of someone else's pathology. And what usually happens is that the people who become victims of narcissists are people who have empathy, who are eager to please. For example, that person who grew up always taking responsibility for the family. The person that I call the child who filled all the family vacancies, who felt that holding the family was up to them. Like, for instance, the child of an alcoholic or the child of a single parent. someone who felt overly responsible for everybody around them. Put that person with a narcissist, and the narcissist will exploit that person first by making them feel really important and valued, and then demanding more and more and more until the person is literally sucked dry. Mm. And so I've just given you a graphic illustration of how mental illness can be caused in a workplace.
Mm. And corporate bullying.
Yeah.
Mm. Because, and as you say, some of us, as we climb up the corporate ladder, you know, the dark side comes out. And it would be easier, actually, Len, I think, if the dark side came out like outside and everyone could see.
Overtly.
Yes. Yeah. It's just that you'll find that we have a way of dealing with our dark side, that I can seem to be very sweet and I can seem to be very empowering and everything, but on the side, there's this child or this person that I'm almost treating like a stepchild or an unwanted child. But I do that when no one else is watching. Mm. And then when everyone else is watching, I give the person attention and positive feedback, such that the person even doubts that what is happening to the person.
Are my feelings legitimate?
Exactly. Mm, right. They're thinking, no, I'm missing something, you know, I'm losing my mind. Mm. Because in front of everyone, this person is super sweet, super nice. But when it's the two of you, it's different. It does happen in corporate.
Absolutely.
Mm. I mean, is there a difference in mental illness between male and female employees in the workplace? Or is it all similar?
Well, I think in general, mental illness in men is underdiagnosed and underreported.
Mm.
And often it manifests, for example, in alcohol abuse, aggression. So it doesn't always show up as directly a mental illness or stress or burnout as it would for women. But and also women are much, much better and more skilled at getting support from each other and from bosses. Men are pathetic at turning to each other for support or admitting that they've got any issues. And so, you know, men tend to be more isolated. And that's why, you know, the rates of suicide in men is much higher than in women.
Yep.
Mm. And also, you know, when men attempt suicide, they use lethal methods.
Mm. Yeah.
So even if statistically more women try than men do, but more men succeed because women try methods that are not lethal and they act as a cry for help and they can be helped afterwards.
Mm.
So and of course, everything we're saying about the workplace applies to school and to children.
Mm.
You know, and all these same principles are exactly the same for children. And boys, if you look at who fills the prisons, who has more attention deficit disorder, who has more alcoholism, who has more suicide, mental illness, much higher rates amongst men, which means that men's issues are not being paid enough attention to. You know, even though obviously we're concerned about women's issues from the point of view equality and creating equity in the workplace, but I think men's issues are sometimes eclipsed by that.
I tend to agree fully, Ron. I think there's something about men, maybe I don't understand because I'm not a man, the macho-ness that, you know, I have to appear to be strong. I can't let this, you know. And in most instances, you'll find that men are mostly in leadership positions.
Mm.
So it's almost like it's a reflection of being a weak leader if you're going to admit that you're going through this. Whereas I think it's not easy. It's easier for us as women. The reason it's not easy yet is that there still is a stigma attached to mental health and mental illness. And there's an issue around the socioeconomic level of where you are to say, no, this is a disease for poor people. Yeah. If you are at that level, you can't be.
Mm.
But that's not the case. It's actually, it can affect anyone at any level in the socioeconomic strata. But women do tend to be outspoken and to talk about it, even if they're not talking to their line managers, but to talk to their friends at least, and that's how they get help. But I think where we need to go as corporate South Africa is to open up the corporate so that both women and men feel that it is safe to open up, to speak up and to seek help, but also to stand up and be role models for other people who might be suffering in silence. Some people have asked me, why was I so open about my sickness? And for me, it was an opportunity to open up about this. And it's something that I believe we really do not know. We're starting to grapple with. But we need examples of people who are going through that and say, how, what happened? How did it manifest? But also, more importantly, how did you cope? And how did the people around you help you cope, and how did they cope? Because the circle of influence is not just around you. It's about the people that you stay with, the people that you work with. Like we're talking with Len before we came in, and I was talking about the impact of my illness on my family. And on the days when I was feeling better, on the good days, I used to look at them and feel sorry for them. And I would apologize until my elder daughter called me to order and said, have you ever heard of someone with cancer apologizing for being sick?
Excuse me, sorry.
But just to add to that, and also to show people that you came through it.
Yes.
And that you're wiser and stronger for having gone through that experience.
To the both of you, we're talking about a corporate, how can we write mental health problems into company policy when it's not always a physical, well, it's not really seen something that's been done before. Is there any attempts to bring it into company policy and how to deal with the issue of mental illness?
At Balawald, we have not attempted to put it in policy. Yeah. And I'll tell you why, Ron. I'm almost scared of creating a policy because human nature is such that if there's a policy that deals with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 9, 10, if something presents as 11, we then are hamstrung. We do not know how to deal with it. So when I've been talking with the leaders at Balawald, I said, we do not have policies, but we have our humanity. Let us use the humanity that we have to ensure that we are able to open up the space, to make it safe for people, but also to help. And it's been interesting because ever since we started focusing on mental health, the number of people that have come forward, the number of people that we've been able to refer to the psychologists that we have, it's increasing. And sometimes people are just coming and volunteering and saying, you know, I really am struggling with this. And we're able to get them, get intervention and get them helped. Because if we don't do that, there's a risk that we label people as underperformers. Because we do not sit and think, unfortunately, mostly as line managers, we do not sit and think that something has changed with this person. This person was a performer. Why are they like this? We quick to label as an underperformer. Instead of saying something is not right, how do we help this person? Because we know not just the potential, but what they have been able to deliver.
If I could just add to that, that's also where stereotyping and prejudice can become a problem. Because, for example, you know, an obstacle that women have is that men's ways of being are generally privileged in the workplace and in the legal system, which means being rational, unemotional, driven, etc. And so when women are emotional, just by nature, and express themselves, they run the risk of being labeled as crazy and, you know, the kinds of things that people do to disqualify people's experience. And so we have to be alert to those vulnerabilities, you know. If someone's depressed and you call them disengaged, you know, that's putting a spin on what you're seeing. And that is a very hard label to fight.
And you know, to that, it's interesting because as the group expert, Balod, we've gone through what we call a consciousness coaching, consciousness leadership coaching. And it talks to that when someone is not performing, in inverted commas, when someone is not doing what you believe they should be doing, our first recourse now has to be, what is it that I, as a leader, am doing or not doing that causes that person to be like that? And not jump into what's wrong with that person.
Mm.
So we need to sit in our own skin and say, what about me as this leader? How am I showing up in my leadership that could have an impact on other people? And some people might call it EQ and, you know, all of that. But it's about the consciousness that leadership need to have about the impact that we have in the people around us.
Mm. So I would put that in a, give a very simple practical tip for doing that. If a leader looked at a report, at an employee, and said, if this was my child, how would I describe this problem? Because often you'll see, if you think of the, if you look at it as if you were looking at your own child, you would see the person very, very differently than if you're looking at them as an other, as a commodity.
Yeah, as a tool, as an asset.
As an asset.
As an asset,
right.
As an asset,
as an asset,
right.
Yeah.
How do you create these safe working spaces? I mean, can rewarding employees with social activities compensate for depression? How do we create these environments within corporations? That,
See, it's not about rewarding. It's about creating a culture that allows people to be human. You know, something that I observed in many companies that I worked for, which is an unintended consequence of something quite negative, and that is the fact that people have to smoke outside. So it's amazing how many positive interactions and how much mixing of people at different levels in the company happens in parking lots because they're smoking together. And sometimes that can, even though it's a very bad thing, and I don't endorse smoking in any way, but it's incredible what creativity and sort of cross-pollination can happen in a company because of that. So so companies have to create environments where people can bring their whole self to work, not just one aspect of themselves, that a technical aspect that does the job, their playfulness, their creativity, their warmth, everything. And that enriches the general atmosphere and culture of the company. And also, I mean, I know if I'm consulting in a company and someone's phone goes and it's their wife or their husband or their child, and they'll apologize and I'll say, take it. Because I actually respect someone more for putting their family first than pushing the family aside because they think this is such an important discussion. Because at the end of the day, your family is your long-term investment. Jobs come and go. Your family is your lifelong investment. And so companies have to support people in being family members and having healthy family lives as well.
And it is about the culture. It is about creating an environment where, one, people can bring their whole selves, but two, where people are not scared to speak up when there's something that's troubling them. And also ensuring that we try and not get to a point where people are depressed. You know, let's create a culture, because if there's safety, at Balawal to talk about home safe every day. And the home safe every day is both, it's physical, it's psychological, it's emotional. So you need to create that space, but you need the consciousness of creating that. It's not going to happen on its own. Because as you said, we narcissists and everything. So we need to be quite aware of what is it that we're doing with our teams and around our teams. And how do we make sure that when some, if we're sitting and working and it's a deadline and someone's child has hurt herself or himself, that it is okay for that person to say, I am so sorry, team, but I need to go. And it is okay that they go. And the team that's left, we rally behind. We make sure that the thing is delivered. The, you know, the deadline is met. We should never have to sacrifice who we are and the families that we have because of the workspaces.
I mean, earlier, a couple of weeks ago, I had a conversation here about gender-based violence, given the mood in the country. I mean, mental illness at the workplace, does it spill over into to the domestic situation, especially for breadwinners? Does it fill into what happens at home?
Yeah, I would say absolutely it does. And one has to realize that this is a cycle. Because if someone brings stress home, then that stress plays out in the family, which means that people don't sleep well, which means that they get up stressed, and they take that stress into the schools, into their workplaces. And that pressure cooker of stress, where everyone, you know, arriving with all their different stresses, builds up, and then those people get into taxis or whatever it is, and there's more stress, and they bring that home again, and the cycle continues. For a lot of people, there's no let up, you know, from the stress. And so there is definitely a direct effect, and it works on both sides. Because if someone comes from a happy home where they feel supported and they feel relaxed, even if they got a difficult job, they start their day feeling fortified and feeling like they can face the day. If they're coming depressed and anxious or hurt and broken from home, they don't have the strength to face the day. And similarly, what they take home from work, you know, helps them with their family life. So they're directly linked.
Yeah, I'm gonna share a story. So we went on a study tour in the US, and in this company that we went to, one of the guys who works there was telling us about when he was struggling with his work and how it ended up impacting his family. And the wife kicked him off the bedroom and he was sleeping in the couch. And how when he dealt with the issues at work, the issues at home dissipated. And so we were laughing and joking and asked him, so are you back in the bedroom now? And he was back. But it's that there is an impact on the people around you, irrespective of where they are. That's why you cannot divorce yourself and make yourself this person when you get to Balo World while you are this person when you are at home. You are the same person. The things that ring true for me at home are the things that ring true for me in Balo World.
All right. No, thank you so much for this conversation. That was so insightful for me. That was clinical psychologist Leonard Carr and Dandaso Forbes, Group Executive, Human Capital Transformation and Internal Audit at Balo World. I wish we could continue on with this program, but thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.